look forward to hearing your word again.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Dennis. Well, good morning. Good to be back with you again. I'm thinking maybe I should go crazy on the blog. I might get more followers that way. That seems to be the trend these days. But it is great to be with you, and we are honored to have you as a part of this network of over 60 churches that's otherwise known as the Mid-Maryland Baptist Association. It's an honor to preach to you today. Really appreciate Pastor Kip and the trust that he puts in me by allowing me to occupy space that normally is his responsibility. And I want to talk to you today a little bit about facing the things that you have ahead of you with your feet firmly on the ground. And one of the best places to go for that in the Bible is the book of Ecclesiastes. And so if you have a copy of God's Word, you have an iPad, however it is that you access His Word, join me in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. And we're going to be looking at the book, at least the first chapter of that book, from this perspective. I think you guys have some great things ahead of you. You have a great future in front of you. I've been excited to see, kind of taking a step of faith, the multi-site aspect of what you're doing, using technology that general revelation has given us in order to get the word of Jesus out more widely spread. I'm very, very glad to hear that. Oftentimes, though, when we dream, we tend to do so with inflated views of ourselves. And so whether we're talking about a church or whether we're talking about individuals, and I don't know about you, but sometimes I have that difficulty as well, and somebody has to drag me back down to earth. I'm a visionary by nature, and so I'm not just preaching at someone. This morning, really, this is a text, and really the entire book hits me right in the face. Because again, I'm a visionary by nature. I like to think about the future. I love to dream big. But I also have a staff, and occasionally they pull me back and go, I don't know if we can pull this off. And so I have to have that. But I'm sure probably everybody else in the room has dealt with this at one form or another, at some time or another. How many of you have ever had someone look at you and say, use this well-worn phrase, welcome to the real world? How many of you have uttered that phrase to your children or to an employee or something? Yeah, this is the real world. I remember the first time I ever heard, at least to my memory, the first time I ever heard that phrase, it came from my father. I was 16, 17 years old. I don't remember the exact age, but I do remember the precise circumstances because my first car, I'll admit to you, was a 1978 Ford Pinto. Okay? You can all just feel impressed right now. Yeah. Had a sunroof. Okay? Yeah, it did. They came with them. All right? Factory installed. Glass hatchback, and yes, the gas tank on the back that would explode. But I was really proud of this thing. I still talk about it with fondness occasionally, like I'd like to find it. My wife just rolls her eyes at me, so I don't know. There's something about a dude in his first car. But I remember other people having pretty much the same reaction to my car that I saw some of you have just a few seconds ago, because it's a Pinto. And so I thought, well, I'll show them. And so I pulled out of the parking lot of my high school, and there's a side street that turns onto a four-lane main street that ran right in front of my high school in my hometown, upstate South Carolina. And so when I decided, when both lanes were clear, all my buddies are over here, they've been making fun of my car ever since I got it, and I thought, all right, I'll show them. It was a straight drive, so I dropped the clutch, and the back wheels, they started spinning, okay? And then a few seconds later, kids, don't try this at home. I'm not endorsing this. I'm just telling you a story, okay? But it was fun, though. I'll put it that way. And so spinning, we start the forward momentum when I start to smell smoke. And I look behind me, and there's smoke boiling up out of off the road, out of the tires, and beginning to come into the window, okay, as I move out to the middle of the road. And then I start to feel it go sideways. So I drop it in second, pop the clutch again. She barks again. Okay, this is a testosterone-baptized moment of glory, if there ever has been one, and I am incredibly impressive as a 16-year-old kid, looking in my mirror, watching my buddies do this. I was the man of the hour, right? Until I got straightened up really good and looked in my rearview mirror and realized I'd pulled out in front of my dad. Now, it's 4.5 miles from my high school to my parents' house. And during that 4.5 miles, and I don't know where you guys are on eschatology, and other our 60-some-odd churches are all over the board on the timing of the rapture and all that, but I got to tell you, in that 4.5 miles, I was praying that my pre-trib friends were right, and I was praying that it was going to happen soon, okay? Like in the next 10 minutes, Lord Jesus, please, because the Antichrist has got nothing on an angry father, right? And so you're going down the road, and you say, what is this? And I thought at first I was being let off the hook because I pulled into the driveway. My dad pulled in behind me. He got out of his truck. He walked right up to me before he walked into the house, man, a few words that he always was, and this is all he said. He just walked right up about that close to me. He said, boy, next time that car needs tires, you're buying them. And then he just turned and walked into the house. And I went, he didn't ask me for the keys. He didn't ask me for my license. I'm still alive. This is great. This will be cool. So you know what I did? I went out and did it some more. Yeah. And you know what happened 2 months after that? I had to spend roughly two-thirds of the money I made that summer mowing lawns and doing things like that on a set of Goodyear tires. And when I'm shelling out all that money for that tires, I remember my dad looking at me, big smile on his face, and he said, son, welcome. There you go. See? Yeah, you've been there too, maybe one way or another. Occasionally, we've got to have experiences. We've got to have people who jerk us. And for you, it might have been your mother, your father, could have been a school teacher. For some of you, you may have had to have gone to the extreme of a Marine drill sergeant. But all of us at some point or another have been yanked down out of the clouds, feet set firmly back on the ground to give us a perfect picture of reality. And you don't have a greater picture of that in the Bible than in the book of Ecclesiastes. And there's really no person better to give us that perspective than the author, who identifies himself as in verse 1. He says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So we're talking about Solomon here. And so we're talking about a guy who's not just waxing philosophical, although in Ecclesiastes we do have a 3,000-year-old piece of philosophy that predates lots of the Greek philosophers that we often quote. A wise man, but a man who is wise by experience. There's a background story to everything that we're about to read, and it really begins all the way back in creation, but for the context of this story, it begins back with Solomon's father, David. You remember King David, ushers in the first golden age of Israel. He's a great and mighty warrior. He's a man after God's own heart. Unfortunately, deep down inside, he's also a man fallen in sin, which means at least on one occasion, he was a pervert. He goes out on his roof one day, he sees a woman, desires her, calls for her, sleeps with her, gets her pregnant. Then he decides, well, I've got to try to cover this up. And so at the end of the story, has her husband murdered as a result of his own sin. Nathan the prophet then calls him out. David repents of his sin. He's forgiven by God. You and I will see him one day in heaven if we too have been forgiven. But unfortunately, David's sin brings great consequences for himself, for his family, and for the rest of the nation of Israel. And you fast forward until the time that David is on his deathbed, and you discover him giving Solomon words of wisdom. And he tells his son, you need to keep your nose in the Scriptures, you need to keep your eyes on the living God, and you need to follow Him, and you will not make some of the same mistakes that your old man made. And if Solomon had only heeded that advice, his life might have turned out differently, right? We know that if we've read the story. In fact, it does start out differently. By the time we get to 2 Kings chapter 3, we see that Solomon is newly installed, youthful king of Israel, and he is approached by God himself. And God says to him, I will give you anything you want. Now, how many of you, you've already got in your mind, I know what I would ask for. If God showed up one night in a vision and said, you got one shot, anything you want, name it, I'll grant it. See, some people, immediately, there's all the standard answers to that. Like, well, I want money because I want to be rich, right? Food is delicious and wine makes the heart merry, but money is the answer for everything, right? I want to be rich. Some of you are, I want power. I want control, complete control over my own life. Some of you are, I want fame. I want to be famous, okay? I want a blog site with more than 12 people following it, right? I want that kind of thing. For some of you, it's maybe a little more practical. You know, I'd like to be more attractive. And I'm talking to the guys, not necessarily the ladies, okay? I'd like the hair that I used to have. I'd like for the hair that's coming out in different places to go away. I'd like for, you know, some of those kinds of things. And then others still are just all out. It's about me. Look, Lord, I want my own lane on I-70. That's what I want. Just for me, so when I'm going into work, all right, if you're making that commute in and out of Baltimore, you know what I'm talking about. Solomon contemplated what his answer would be, and this is what he said to the Lord, realizing that he's young and simultaneously had just inherited what was at that time the superpower in the earth. He says, Lord, give your servant an understanding mind to govern your people that I may discern between good and evil. In other words, he asked for wisdom. Give me what I know I don't have to run this nation. And the Bible says that God was so pleased with that response that he said to Solomon, you know what? You didn't ask for wealth, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Solomon, you didn't ask for power, but I'm going to give you more than you already have. You didn't ask for fame, but I'm going to give you everything even that you didn't ask for. And in addition to that, I'm going to grant your request for wisdom as well. And Solomon goes on, lives at least in the early part of his administration a godly life and tries to rule with godly authority. But it began a slippery slope in a couple of different ways. Number one, he worshiped God in the wrong way. He began to set up altars on the high places. And rather than worship God the way God described, he would worship in the traditions of the pagans that were around him. The second thing that he did was, out of a desire for a political alliance, he married into a family that did not know and worship the one true and living God. So this is a woman who comes into his life, and then a few years later, a few more, and then a few years later, a few more after that, until finally, by the end of his life, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He has all of these women. He has incredible wealth. He has unparalleled power. And at the end of his life, he writes Ecclesiastes, and he says, you know what? There's not much to this. This is really a meaningless exercise. This is the real world. And there are several lessons that he wants to teach us in the midst of all of this. Number one, our labors under the sun are in vain. Look with me, continuing in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils? And again, there's that phrase again. It's very significant. Under the sun. Under the sun. It's going to occur a number of different times throughout this book. And under the sun, he says, life is vanity. Some of you may have a translation that says meaningless. Others, it'll say vapor. But if you get a fully orbed understanding of what this means, the word occurs about 38 times in the Old Testament. You got to take the various nuances of it and put it together, and you begin to understand why Solomon chooses this word as the one in which he most repeatedly refers to life in the real world. Because essentially, he's saying, I have all of everything. I've got all the money. I got all the power. I got all the women. I've got all the prestige. I've got all the fame. And even with all of that, having collected everything to myself, here's my conclusion. Life is a dud. Life is meaningless. Life moves very quickly. It ends very suddenly. Life is frustrating. It can be lived apart from God. And as a result, it can not only be missed, it can be lived completely apart from meaning. And I know what some of you may be thinking. You're saying, well, I can't imagine how somebody would feel like that and be in the lifestyle that Solomon lives. I mean, if I were rich, if I were powerful, if I had 1,000 beautiful women at my house every night, I'd be a happy guy. Well, Solomon already had all of that, and he's not happy. He's not. Sometimes we watch entertainment programming on cable television, and we see a big star, and we see a drug addiction, or we see like with Tiger Woods, a sexual addiction, or we see some other thing going on. And in our judgmental minds, we look at that picture and we think, how in the world could they be that way? How could they be that depressed? How could they commit suicide? How could they OD on drugs? I mean, good grief, look at them. They're world famous people. They've got incredible talent. They've got all this money. As if all of that stuff somehow made them less sinful and less broken than those of us whose lives are not on television every day. All that stuff didn't make their lives less broken. What it did is it took their just as broken lives and broadcast them to the world. So you got to be careful when you ask for fame, because people won't just see the good stuff. They'll see all of the skeletons in the closet as well. At least they will eventually. And Solomon has discovered this. He says, this is a dud. It's a dud. And you have to understand, again, the context in which he speaks. He's not just waxing about hopelessness and emptiness and a meaningless life. He's saying the context for this is under the sun. If the sum total of your experiences are limited to your senses, and that's all you're counting on, and the only resources toward which you reach in order to fulfill your life, you will have a meaningless, empty, purposeless life. That's life under the sun, life apart from the Creator. That's the context of this. And as a result, your labor is in vain. What good does it do you to go to school? What good does that do? What good does it do for you to get a secure job? What good does it do for you to build lots of wealth? Those things in and of themselves are not evil, but if you limit your experiences to now the ultimate purpose of my life is to get master or doctor behind my name, or to have a certain number of children, or to build a certain kind of home, or to live in a certain kind of area, Howard County, third most affluent place on North American soil. I know I'm not preaching to anybody in this room, right? I want to live there. That's the ultimate place. That's our ultimate destination. And that's the end of it. Well, Solomon would say, listen, your life is one day going to come to a very abrupt end. They're going to put you in the ground, and everything you own is going to be given to somebody else. Your labor is in vain. And you say, well, yeah, but in the meantime, I'll make a difference, right? I mean, I can make a mark on this world. Well, possibly, but not without God. Solomon continues in verse 4, and he says, a generation comes and a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. Every morning it comes up in the east, every evening it goes down in the west, right? That hadn't stopped since the dawn of time, when 100 years after you and I are dead and gone, if Jesus hasn't returned, that's the way it's going to happen. He goes on. The streams run into the sea, and the sea is not full to the place. So he's talking about the circuits of the water and how it goes round and round in cyclical pattern. On the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. The wind, verse 6, blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. So when you look at the sun, you look at the wind, you look at the water, you are a part of essentially a global-sized cul-de-sac. All right, everything just goes round and round and round, and this is the way it goes. You're on the merry-go-round for a little while until you die and fall off. That's what he's saying. Hope that's encouraging to you, right? Because that's what he's saying. He's saying, and you know what? When you die, the merry-go-round keeps spinning. And so Solomon's point here is, under the sun, you can't make the difference you think you can make because you fundamentally misunderstand that life is not forward linear progression. It's a huge cycle. And you're like, well, yeah, but there's all kinds of diseases that would kill people decades ago, and we can cure those diseases now. And you're right. We can. And the death rate is still one per person. Ultimately, we can't stop it. But we put a guy on the moon, yes, and then we use that same technology to develop weapons of mass destruction so that we might destroy each other. I'm not sure if we could call that progress. You see, don't mistake movement for progress. They're two entirely different things. You can move backwards, right? That can happen. So don't mistake movement for progress. We have all kinds of new technology that we didn't have before. We're able to broadcast. I can actually be in two places at once. A little while ago, I was here and I was in Columbia at the same time. That's progress. Well, it's movement. It's movement. And we've taken some technological advance and we're using it now in a way that glorifies Jesus, and that's wonderful. It's just a shame that 90% of it is actually used to promote a porn culture, on which we spend in this country today more money than professional football, baseball, and basketball combined every single year. All the cheap technology that you're using here to do your video venue, you know where that originated? Pornography. That's where it got started. Now, it can be redeemed, and you've proven that it can be redeemed. But when we talk about new technology as a sign of progress, not necessarily. And if it stays under the sun, those are the inevitable results of it. And Solomon says, all of this means that the ultimate impact on our world is minimal. Every generation thinks we're going to make a difference. Whether it was the builders born around World War II, whether it was the boomers born just afterwards, whether it was my generation, the busters or Gen X as they call us, we all have different approaches. One philosopher put it this way, life is like a ginormous exercise bike. It's stationary. One generation gets on and they pedal like mad until they die and fall off, and then the next generation gets on, looking at the corpse next to them going, well, they didn't make it anywhere, but I will pedal harder. All right, I got this figured out. All those people before us, they were dumb. Evolution has hit its peak with us. We're going to figure this out. Right? Every new generation says that, and this reality has beaten every single generation, and Solomon tells us it will continue. to beat every single generation. You can't just pedal harder on a stationary bike. So what ends up happening is we all seek to find some routine, because intuitively, eventually we get to the point, and it's usually around the age of somewhere between 35 and 40, where we realize I'm not going to make nearly the crater-sized difference in the planet that I thought I was going to make. So we try to find a routine in the circuit in the earth that we intuitively now know is there that just won't drive us insane and cause us to kill our neighbors. Right? So let's find something that we can tolerate until we die and they put us in the ground and they forget about us. So, but Joel, all these developments, they came about by new ideas, right? Strategies, plans, things that nobody before has ever thought of. Well, I'm not so sure about that either. Look at verse 8. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there such a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. Okay? So in some form or fashion, new ideas are nothing more than just an older notion that's been warmed over and repackaged. You put it in the microwave, you pop it out, you go, oh, look, fresh. No, microwaved. All right? There's a difference. And essentially, that's what Solomon's saying. There's no such thing as a freshly created idea. There's just warmed over microwaved stuff that looks new, smells new, but in reality, it's just a repackaged thing. Here in about 5 days, we're going to celebrate the 239 years this year since the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and you'll hear people get up, and I thank God to live in a country like this, and I'm as patriotic as the next guy, but you'll hear people get up, and they'll broadcast this sense of America as somehow above and beyond everybody else in the world, like we're better than everybody else, and a lot of times what they'll root that in is the history that surrounds that declaration, which I'm very thankful for, but the laws that came after it, particularly in 1789 with our Constitution and with the implementation of that in this country, and they'll say the thing about America is it was a unique idea that had never been thought of before. And I'm sitting there going, oh, sure, a Roman constitutional republic. Nobody ever thought of that before. See, there's no new ideas. There's just warmed over, repackaged old ideas. Okay? And they can do some good things on the earth. I think we'll celebrate the results of that in 5 days. I'm not against that at all. I look forward to shooting off fireworks. Outside Howard County, of course. But I look forward to doing that. Yeah. You see, but ultimately we've got to realize these are old. And then he continues in verse 9 by saying, we can't think of anything, we can't try anything, we can't work at anything that hasn't been thought of, tried, or worked at before. Because again, it's just a continuous cycle. See, there's a difference between movement and progress, but there's also a qualitative difference between information, which is ideas, and the successful implementation of those ideas. And Solomon says, there's nothing you can possibly think of that hasn't already been thought of before. And you know what, guys? He said that 3,000 years ago. How much more true do you think that is today? That's hard for us to acknowledge. That's why we sell out to causes and movements and isms. It's why gerrymandering politicians and demographers are so successful in setting us into separate groups and setting us at war with each other, as we see so often on talk radio and hear so often on talk radio and see so often on the various news programs every night. It's because we buy into these things thinking we'll join this and we'll defeat these people over here because they're our perceived enemy and that will make a difference in the world. And at the end of the day, Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow get a little bit richer and everything else pretty much stays the same. It's because we can't do this. You're looking at this crooked mess called Earth. Understand that you cannot think of any workable solution that somebody hadn't already tried. And the author of this book, who was the wisest, most powerful, most wealthy man who ever lived, this is Bill Gates, Albert Einstein, and Hugh Hefner, all rolled up into one guy. That's who Solomon was. And he says, I've tried it. I've lived it. Forget it. It's already been conceived, it's already been tried, and it's already failed because your new ideas are, in essence, just regurgitated old ideas. And if you weren't depressed enough already, You might be thinking, well, you know, I'm going to make a difference, right? Because I am somebody. I will become important. Joel, you can't deny there have been people who've made a huge mark on history. The Martin Luther Kings and the Billy Grahams and the George Washingtons and the Nelson Mandelas of the world. They have made a mark. And you know what? I can do that too. I can be important. And one day they're going to make monuments to me. They're going to name high schools after me. They'll have holidays named after me. It's possible that that might be the case, but if you go far enough into the future, you'll discover that they will not remember you. And that's what Solomon goes on to say, beginning in verse 11. He says, "There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after." Here's the truth of the matter from Solomon. You are born, you're going to live, one day you're going to die, they're going to put you in the ground, and far enough into the future, nobody's going to remember who you are. You say, "I just can't believe that." Really? I'll prove it to you. Who was in the obituaries this morning? See? Nobody remembers you. You make the paper twice in your life, when you're born and when you die, and you don't make, they completely ignore you in the middle unless you just do something stupid. I mean, isn't that life? That's life, okay? And Solomon says, this is the truth of the matter. They will not ultimately remember you. Even those names that I called out, the Abraham Lincolns, the Martin Luther Kings, the George Washingtons, if we could get in a time machine and go far enough into the future, if Jesus has not yet come back, I guarantee you we would arrive at a moment in time when nobody will know who those people are. And if you find that hard to believe, just watch late night television one night when the comedians go out into the street and hold up a picture of President Obama and people don't know who he is. And I'm looking at my wife going, "Oh, Lord, please tell me these people don't vote." But they don't know. And I understand that that represents the lowest of IQs in our society. I get that. Okay? But eventually, even the smartest of us we'll lose. Our memory goes away. We forget. We forget too easily. And essentially that's what Solomon's saying here. If that's the overinflated view you have of yourself, then you must be one of those people who thinks history began the year you were born. Because all this has been tried before. All this has been done before. All this has failed before. And under the sun, you got to remember that three-word phrase because that's the important context here. The hope comes, but it doesn't come under the sun. Under the sun, this is the reality of things. And Solomon proves that to be the case with his own life as well. He goes on in verse 12 and he says, "I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem." You say, "I'm going to make a difference." I don't know. The scriptures seem to indicate here that you're not going to make the difference you think you're going to make, at least not under the sun, at least not by yourself, at least not using only your own senses. You say, "Well, how do you know that?" Well, I don't know. This guy was king over the most powerful nation at that time in the history of the world, and he couldn't make a dent. "I was king, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven." And here's his conclusion. "It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done and under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind." Trying to get meaning and purpose out of life using just your five senses is like trying to capture the wind and put it in a bottle and take it home. It is a useless, futile exercise. That's what Solomon tells us here. And then he goes on to say, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted." And so what you have here is a guy who has tried all kinds of different lifestyles, all kinds of different philosophies, and he's not found satisfaction in any of them. What is crooked cannot be made straight. This is a crooked mess, this world. And our lives are a crooked. You see, the reason that evil exists, the reason we have war, the reason that children, 26,000 of them precisely, every single day around the world die from usually starvation, but also other kinds of otherwise preventable diseases, the reason that we have the horror that we have, the threat of nuclear war, rogue nations throughout the Middle East, those kinds of, the reason we have those things is not because the evil is out there. It's because the evil is ever present in the souls of every single human being who's created in God's image and likeness. That's where it's at. I can't fix the world because I can't even fix me. I can't even control my temper when I'm in traffic. How in the world am I supposed to solve world hunger? By myself in a way that is disconnected from my Creator. I can't do it. That's the truth of this passage. This is Solomon pulling our head out of the clouds, putting our feet firmly on the earth. And he's a guy who said, I've tried it. I've looked for meaning in different philosophies. Then he goes on to say, I've looked for meaning in other approaches to life. This is what's funny to me when he says in verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And then he goes on to say, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Now notice this. I applied my heart to know both wisdom and to know madness and folly. Okay? When you translate the nuances of those terms, he's essentially talking about high culture and low culture. All right. So if Solomon were alive in the 21st century, this is what that phrase might sound like. He would say, I looked at the highbrow life and I thought, maybe the answer lies there. Maybe I can find the purpose for my existence there. And so I bought all Armani suits and tickets to the opera. I learned how to use the salad fork. I pretended that large people screaming at me in falsetto was an enjoyable experience. Okay? I did all of these things, and I discovered, you know what? With all the wealth and all the cultural prestige and now being educated beyond my intelligence, using words that even I don't understand, as one of the elite members of society, I'm just as broken as I was before I got into this. And so then he tries madness and folly. This is low culture. Okay? This is dumb and dumber, Tommy Boy, it's that kind of stuff. Right? This is what I'm gonna do. So I'm gonna go over there and I'm wearing my Armani, that didn't make me happy. The guys across the street over there in the trailer park, they look kind of happy. I mean, they're drunk and not real bright, but they look happy, you know. I know some of you are thinking that's mean. Listen, I'm talking about my people now, okay? I grew up in upstate South Carolina. I can talk about my own people, amen? I can do it. So he said, all right. So he sheds the Armani suit, puts on a NASCAR t-shirt, buys a trailer, takes the furniture out of it, puts it all out in the front yard. Not sure why he did it, but he didn't want to stand out, you know? All the neighbors were doing it. Gets some fireworks, shoots them off in the middle of August for no particular reason. Just kind of seemed like a fun thing to do, you know? And so I'm going to live this life. He said, you know what? I'm still broken. I can't find purpose and meaning. There's nothing wrong with living that kind of life. Thank God, that's what I lived. I love that kind of life. But there's nothing inherently wrong with it, but you're not going to find ultimate meaning there. There's nothing inherently wrong with going to the opera, but you're not going to find ultimate meaning there. And I can imagine Solomon tried other approaches. You know, let's look across town over there at the middle class, over the suburbanites. Hey, that looks cool. I'll try that. So I trade the F-150 in for a Volvo. I buy all lemon yellow sweaters and khaki pants. I start eating tofu. I buy a terrier. I think I'm describing some of you. Maybe that's why I'm getting a reaction. And he says, yeah, this doesn't solve it either. You know, there's nothing wrong with any of it, but you're not going to find ultimate meaning that way. Solomon says, I've tried it all. I've tried wisdom and knowledge. I've tried madness and folly. I've tried everything in between. If you move through the rest of Ecclesiastes, you actually discover everything from asceticism to hedonism and everything in between, the kind of philosophies that Solomon is appealing to in that book, and he says they all come up empty. At the end of the day, I'm just as broken as I was before. I've tried every extreme, and I've discovered two things. Number one, there's no approach to life that helps me arrive at meaning and identity. And number two, there are no new approaches to life that haven't been tried yet. I've tried them all. And so many of us live in contradiction to that, thinking that we're going to find meaning in something else. And for some of us, it's money, you know. When I make this level of salary, then I'll be happy. And what's interesting is you probably don't have to go back too many years. If you're the kind of person who says that, you probably don't have to go back too many years before you were saying, when I was making, and you were quoting the amount you're making right now, and you said, I'll be happy. And it hasn't made you happy. For some of you, it's power. When I get a supervisor's job, then I'll be happy. Boy, I hate all this stuff that's happening at the local government level. I'll get on the county council, and then I'll be happy. Listen, I've talked with our wonderful public servants over the last month or so about some things that may even affect our churches. They have worked tirelessly, whether you agree with them or not. But I tell you, I don't want that job. And I doubt seriously you find ultimate fulfillment in it. But so many people still think it. I'm looking for power. I'm looking for prestige. I'm looking for wisdom. When I get that next degree, then I'll have it. I'll arrive. And that actually brings us to the last verse, because Solomon was the wisest of all people in the earth. There was not one that had been wiser up until that point. There would not be another one wiser beyond his time. And this was the conclusion of his wisdom that God had given him is in verse 18. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Bottom line, the more you know, the more depressed you become. Sometimes ignorance really is bliss. Solomon says, not only do I see the wickedness around me, but God has given me wisdom so that I know exactly why it has happened. I know my own contribution to it as a sinner myself, and I know ultimately that there's nothing I can do about it. Ultimate knowledge of that reality in and of itself under the sun will not bring relief. It will not bring meaning. It will bring vexation. It will bring sorrow. And the rest of the book, at least until the end, is pretty much like this. So if you feel like maybe you're a little too happy, you should go home and read the rest of Ecclesiastes, because it really does set things in order in a very somber way. Because this is a testimony of a guy who, with all of his power, with all of his money and all of his fame, realized, I am, even as king of Israel, I am impotent to solve anything. I can't do it. I can't do anything about it. You're like, well, where's the hope? Well, it's not under the sun, I'll tell you that. It comes from somewhere else. It comes from the wisdom that is personified, not just here in Ecclesiastes, but also in Job, in Psalms, in the Song of Solomon, in Proverbs. And Solomon himself writes not only Ecclesiastes, but Proverbs and the Song of Songs. And we find wisdom personified there. And a millennium after these words are written, we see the personification of that wisdom take on human flesh in the person of Jesus. And that's where you and I find our hope. That's where we find our hope. Solomon knew our problem. He knew it intimately, more so than any other human being on the planet, and he couldn't fix it. But Jesus comes to live among us because we can't go to him. Jesus lived the life that you and I live with all of its frustrations and all of its problems and all of its temptations, but in a wisdom much greater than Solomon. Jesus didn't look for satisfaction ultimately in any of those things. He was without sin. And in being without sin, he lived for us the life that we were destined to live, frankly, the only kind of life that God will accept if we're to have fellowship with him, one of complete and sinless perfection. And the scriptures tell us throughout the New Testament narratives that the rest of the world looked at that perfect, sinless life, and it was strange to them. It looked, because by that point in history, we had become so marred in our own sinfulness that human perfection actually looked perverted to us. And so we killed him. But then God, 3 days later, raised him from the dead. Used his death as a substitute for human sin. God caused him who knew no sin to become sin for us. And again, he lived our life on our behalf. He died a death that we deserve because the wages of sin is death. And then rose from the dead. And here's the bottom line. Solomon knew about sin, but he couldn't forgive it. Only Jesus can. Solomon knew the dilemma that sin created, but he couldn't solve it. Only Jesus can. Solomon knew the ultimate purpose of human life, but he couldn't live it. Only Jesus could. Solomon was aware of the enormous sin debt that humanity owed God, but with all of his wealth, he could not pay it. Only Jesus could. And this is why Jesus himself tells us in Matthew chapter 12, there is one who is greater than Solomon who is here. So Solomon's right. Under the sun, absent from revelation, no Jesus, no God breaking into human history to speak to us, if that's all we're looking at, what our five senses can pick up, we have no hope. There is no ultimate reality. There is no ultimate meaning. It is all vanity. It's all meaningless. It's a vapor. Here's the good news. God, who is above the sun, God, who is above creation, comes into this fallen world on our behalf. And it's interesting because one of the first visitors to Jesus after his birth were the Magi, the wise men. And if you and I seek wisdom and ultimately we find it, we end up in the same place where these wise men entered, where these wise men found themselves, which is on our knees at the feet of Jesus, who is wisdom personified. That's when you can start to make a difference as an individual. That's when the church begins to make a difference. But you cannot do it simply using things under the sun. It has to be through Him. Life has no meaning, no purpose, no goal unless it's connected to the one who creates it. And that's really the point here of Ecclesiastes and of this text specifically. The wisest man who ever lived couldn't even fathom how to begin putting our broken world together. But Jesus, through His death and resurrection, does it. There is meaning to life, but it's only found in Jesus. And there is purpose to life, but it's only found in Jesus. And there is truth that forms the foundation for living a life that will have a great impact. But it is only discovered exclusively in Jesus. And I pray you find that today. If you haven't found it, I pray your church remains steadfast on it. God has done incredible stuff through you. One of the fun things about my job is seeing the things that God does through churches. And what He's done through Bethany Church over the last 3-4 years has been amazing to me. The new technology is wonderful, but it will not take you to the next level. You can utilize it to get you there, but it will not be what gets you there. It is the same foundation upon which you were started as a church, the same hope to which you have appealed for the last several years as you sought your future. It is in Jesus. Find Him if you have not found Him. Cling to Him and rest and remain in Him. Let's pray. Lord, thank You for the opportunity to break Your word and to share with Your people. Thank You for what I see You doing in so many of our churches. And in particular, I thank You for Your people here at Bethany. I thank You for the way in which You've used them to make the spread of the gospel more wide, even in this area and in this county. And Lord, as we enter into a new week, I pray that they would find their assurance, their purpose, their meaning in You. And Lord, maybe there's some here who, like me, get off track sometimes and they start looking for their ultimate hope in something other than in You, and they find out it's futile, it's meaningless. More money doesn't solve it. More power doesn't solve it. All those things that Solomon tried doesn't solve it, and I pray that they would recommit themselves to You today. Lord, there may be someone here who doesn't know You, and they've never confessed You as Lord. They've never repented of their sin, and I pray today that You would help them find their ultimate meaning in You, that they would turn from their sins, that they would place their faith in what You did on behalf of sinners so that all who put their faith in You can be redeemed. They can have their sins forgiven and paid for in full. They will not have to face the wrath of God, but they can be a part of Your family. And Lord, I pray that You would draw those individuals to You this morning. Use this church continually as You have in the past to make His name more widely known. In Jesus' name, amen. Would you stand with me as the musicians come? We're going to have a time of invitation. Dennis is going to come join me at the front. If God is calling you to respond to this message in any way, be obedient to Him as we sing.